Welcome to another edition of No Compromise Christianity, where you're going to hear the stuff you probably won't hear in church. And today, you definitely are going to hear the stuff you won't hear in church, because you're probably not in church if you're in Ontario. Today, I have a very special guest on, Mr. Dr. Reverend Bishop High Priest Dr. Aaron Rock, who planted Harvest Bible Church, formerly known as Southwood Church, in, if I'm not mistaken, according to your website, in 2001. And it quickly grew and established itself in Windsor as a Christ-centered missional church. And we're so thankful. I'm so thankful for Harvest, been such a great ally for us here. So Aaron, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, well, it's my privilege to join you. I'm thankful for your stand for Christ and for the ministry that you're doing in the east end of Windsor. I know that God has used you mightily to impact people for the Lord Jesus Christ. So yeah, as you mentioned, I'm the lead and I guess founding pastor of Harvest Bible Church. I've been pastoring this church for 19 years. I married up. My wife's name is Susie. We've been married for 25 years. We have five children, one of whom is married, another of whom is engaged. Three in total are young adults, and then we have two in high school. And as you know, I've been pretty heavily engaged in the Reopening Ontario Churches initiative, the Niagara Declaration, and I'm just absolutely in love with the local church, and it breaks my heart that because of the circumstances we're in, that as of today in Ontario, it is illegal for any church to meet beyond 10 people. So thanks for having me on the show, and hopefully we can cover some good ground.
Yeah, it was quite shocking when I saw the headlines that you were being criminally charged, like that a pastor was being criminally charged in Canada for the crime of, I guess, doing his job, it seemed. And so elaborate a little bit on the circumstances that led up to that charge and what exactly the charge is.
Yeah. Okay. So just to be clear, it's not considered a criminal charge. So if there's any, you know, pastors out there that are worried about a criminal charge, a criminal record as a result of reopening the church, that's not true. It's technically called a court summons. What makes it unique is that it does have the potential of jail time attached to it, which I don't know of any, not a lawyer, of course, but I don't know of any charge outside of a criminal charge that would have jail time potentially attached to it. So that's what makes it sound like a criminal charge. But essentially what it is it's a court summons, and the court has the Reopening Ontario Act says that the fine range is between $10,000 and $100,000, potentially even a year in jail. And the reason why I was charged with that is because on December the 20th, you know, we felt compelled to exercise our charter rights and to do our duty as Christians to meet and minister to our people and worship our God. So, you know, some have called me a criminal and a lawbreaker. I would take issue with that for the simple reason that the highest law of our land is our Constitution, of which our charter is a part. And I'm guaranteed under that charter the right for peaceful assembly, freedom of religion, and so forth. And then second to that, I'm guaranteed protection under Section 176 of the Criminal Code to be able to officiate at services in the church. So one of the challenges in all of this is that those two things apparently have just been set aside. The charter has just been set aside. The criminal code has been set aside in reference to our activities, and I've been charged nonetheless.
Yeah, many that I've seen, I'm seeing comments and stuff online and on the different articles and stuff, and it seems that many people, even in the church, even people who've professed Christ, believe that, you know, the gathering of the saints, the gathering for worship or gathering for Bible study or prayer or whatever you're gathering for is of secondary importance for public health. Now, I've seen you comment and stuff, and you seem to insist that the church is essential for the holistic health of the individual and of society. So why is it that you insist on that? How would you respond to somebody who's saying, no, it's just of secondary importance. We could just temporarily cancel this thing and everyone will just be fine.
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, human beings are composed of various constituent parts, you could say. So you're looking at me right now, you're looking at my physicality, but you're also listening to me speak, which implies I have a mind which processes information and is able to communicate. From a Christian perspective, we also have a spirit and a soul. I'm a spiritual being. I'm a relational being. You know, the first negative statement in scripture was that Adam was alone. This is prior to sin entering into the world, which indicates that part of being made in the imago Dei, the image of God, is that we are relational beings. So, you know, we can go on, but I think I'm making the point. We're physical, we're emotional, we're relational, we're, you know, psychosocial beings and so forth. And the focus right now, the myopic focus in our culture, is on protecting our physicality at all costs. Now, I'm not opposed to protecting our physicality. I don't want to get a virus. I don't want to die. I don't want to get run over by a car or eaten by a tiger or whatever. So we all take necessary precautions. Of course, there's risks in a physical world. You can never totally insulate yourself from the potential for physical harm. And the, you know, the statistics on death are impressive. You know, joke, joke, ha ha, we all die. But my concern is that lockdowns are simply untenable, and they're untenable, and closed churches are untenable, because we must find a way to continue to minister to the spiritual, the social, the psychological, if you will, the mental, the relational needs of people. And lockdowns do not permit that. Now, fortunately, we have a Bible with certain mandates. So knowing Creator knows his creatures, we're creatures, he's creator. He's given us instructions as to how to meet those needs. We're not to forsake the gathering together of believers. We're to engage in robust incarnational ministry and practice the one another's of scripture, loving one another, forgiving one another, serving one another, rebuking one another, confronting one another, ministering to each other, praying for one another, and on and on and on and on. You cannot do that on Zoom church. You cannot do that. Now, if you have a church of only 10 people, fine, you can meet to the tune of 10 people. But when you have a church of many hundreds of people, you just can't do that. So I've been arguing this point all along. Sometimes I feel like I'm banging my head against the wall, because the only expert, to use societal language, that the premier seems to be interested in listening to is an expert in the area of biotic health, physical health. And I think the mistake that's been made is he's failed to consult people who have expertise in other areas. Now, normally as pastors, we don't sit around, you know, talking about ourselves as, you know, experts. But if we were to adopt societal language, I'm an expert in spiritual health. You know, I have a bachelor's degree, two master's degrees, a doctorate. I've been pastoring for 27 years. That qualifies me as an expert in spiritual health. And I know, as a minister of the gospel, that people suffer when they're cut off from their church and their spiritual life takes a nosedive. And we all kind of felt that experientially during the first lockdown. So I've repeatedly called upon officials to consider a more balanced approach. And I think if we were to consider a more balanced approach, there's actually a simple way for us to move forward as a culture, mitigate, not completely, but mitigate against viral spread, but also, you know, not fill up our hospitals with people who are depressed, who are anxious, who are suicidal. The ministry of robust, faithful churches like ours, I would even go so far as to say, reduces hospitalizations. The hospitals can focus on COVID patients, et cetera, because we are snatching from the fire, so to speak, people with challenges in other areas. So that's the essence of my, you know, my argument and my contention, my conviction, I would say.
Yeah, and I've always held that you, and I think the numbers speak for themselves. You can't stop a virus. People are too unpredictable. Humans are too unpredictable. You cannot stop it with government control and overreach. Some pastors, I'm talking about pastors now. Some pastors have suggested that the church in this season can care for the emotional and mental and spiritual health, as you've discussed, of their people, from a distance, online, as you mentioned, Zoom church, online church. As I've spent so much of my energy before this trying to fight against this idea that online church is legitimate and this is not helping. But so I guess the question I'm trying to ask you here is, can we temporarily care for people from a distance? And if not, why?
Well, I think we can temporarily care for people on a very minimal level for short bursts of time, the absence of physical presence. We do that every week, actually, from Monday to Saturday. That is, if our primary meeting time is on Sunday, which for most churches it is. So, yeah, we're not always connected. We're not always plugged into our local churches. But when you extract people from their church community, especially those that are spiritually immature, are weak, have no support, live by themselves, have current or past addictions, have health crises, have mental health issues, you extract them from their support structure for a week, which turns to 2 weeks, which turns to 28 days, which turns to 2 months and 3 months and so forth. We know where this is going. Okay, we're not stupid. We know what that 2 weeks turned into a couple of months back in the spring. The big question is, what's 28 days going to turn into in the middle of cold and flu season? It's gonna go on and on and on. Guaranteed. And it'll set a precedent for future viral invasions. This is not tenable. It's just simply, how do I say it? A terrible plan for taking care of people. It's a terrible plan. Now, I guess if you, and I don't mean to be cute, but I guess if you happen to be in a church where there's very little outreach, your people have kind of all been there forever. It's a small group, perhaps. Maybe you can get by for extended periods of time without meeting. I don't know how, because it's just not my context. But we have video testimony. We put a church called Church, a video called Church is Essential. We have video testimony of people who came to faith in Christ when our church reopened, or renewed their faith in Christ when our church reopened. And they're using words like suicidal. They're using this language. They're using words like depression and so forth. So I don't feel that I need to justify to the watching world what I do or the lives we impact. The fact of the matter is, I know as a minister of the gospel that we are being used up by God to radically alter and change people's lives as God's people gather and as we minister to one another. Period. I don't need to produce data on that. I know it experientially to be true. And so I need to fight for that. Right, I need to fight for that because I feel that if I don't, I'm relinquishing my responsibilities as a minister of the gospel, and I'm letting my people literally suffer. Every single one of them, no, but a large portion. But let's just maybe step away from the pragmatic arguments and the circumstantial arguments, and just go back to my initial statement. Creatures don't need to ever apologize to other creatures for what the Creator has said, and our Creator, who knows us better than we know ourselves, has commanded us to meet. Period. He's commanded us to meet. He calls us his body. None of us individually represent the fullness of Christ. The Bible uses the imagery of a human bodies. We get the fingers and the hands and the elbows and the whole nine yards. We are insufficient in and of ourselves to sustain our own spiritual lives. I hope people understand that. We are insufficient in and of ourselves to sustain our own spiritual lives. People say, well, I can just hang out with Jesus and pray with them on my own. I don't know what Bible you're reading. The Bible never presents this, you know, Lone Ranger, it's me and Jesus on an island hanging out kind of imagery. It commands us to meet. And each of us plays a vital role in the life of the church. And when we meet, the presence of Christ descends upon his people, and together we reflect the full image of Christ into this broken world. And so this is why, you know, any sort of it's reductionistic to say the church is just sort of like almost like a spectator sport where, well, I'll just pray at home, or we'll produce a fancy sermon for you and throw it up online every Sunday. This isn't church. And it also begs the question, then why even bother having churches? There's enough video sermons out there to sustain every one of us for the rest of our lives without any of us ever preparing a new sermon. So much for preaching into the moment and the circumstances, looking people in the eye and reading your audience and all of that. But again, all of this, you can speak at length about it, has been pushed aside because of one viral threat, which we now know kills a very small fraction of the population. And almost with few exceptions, nobody without pre-existing comorbidities or younger people. Very, very rarely does it happen. Yes, but very, very rarely. And so I just think that we're making a tragic, we've made tragic decisions as a culture, which I think is literally destroying people's lives.
How did you respond when you initially received the charges? Like, did you kind of have a feeling it was coming, or were you shocked? What's the general, first of all, how did you respond? And secondly, what's the general vibe around your congregation? Because it's not every day in the West, at least, that your pastor gets charged for meeting and leading a service.
Yeah. I mean, I've never been arrested in my life. I've never done jail time. I've got a couple speeding tickets. So, you know, I've been a law-abiding citizen. And, you know, I think the Lord kind of prepared me for it a little bit. We had police presence here the week before, just kind of responding to some trumped-up public complaints. So just kind of having them on site sort of prepared me for it. I did participate in a worship protest in Toronto, and there was, you know, officers there that spoke to us. So that kind of settles your heart a little bit. I don't agree with the charges. I don't think they should have been laid. I think there's a lot of hypocrisy from the police, especially, who turned a blind eye. I actually participated in protests in the spring, in June, I believe it was, contrary to, you know, the Emergency Measures Act was in place at the time. That said, I did feel bad for the officer that informed me of the charges. He was clearly distraught and did not want to lay these charges. So, you know, I've had multiple conversations, I think 7 conversations with him in the last couple of weeks about that. So
wait a minute, are you pastoring the police officer through him charging you?
Well, I think so. You know, I think that's my heart in that, because I felt bad for him as a person for having to do something that he clearly didn't want to do. I was very resolved. I don't want to present myself as like Superman, but when the charge came, there's been no fear, no regret, and no diminishment of my resolve whatsoever. And I attribute that to the prayers of God's people and the conviction of the Holy Spirit. So, you know, our people were, some were saddened. I think the majority were probably enraged in a certain way at the injustice of it. Well, I could do the exact same thing in a big box store, no problem. I don't know what other words you can use. It's discrimination. Let's use societal words. It's unjust. It's wrong. It's morally wrong. What happened to me is morally wrong. And, you know, it's historically problematic as well, because you know, we're talking, people have called me, you know, a granny killer. They've used all kinds of nasty words, which I won't mention here. My great-grandfather died on the fields of France for charter freedoms and left behind a widow. And families don't recover from that in a generation. Her children were affected by that economically and so forth. That's part of my family history. I have another great-grandfather and a grandfather that also fought in other wars, and one of which died after as a result of injuries. So my lineage is that, you know, Canadian soldiers have paid the price for these freedoms. My family, not me in my lifetime, but my family, my lineage suffered for these things. And that inevitably affects families for generations. And it's more than mildly offensive when somebody essentially spits on the grave of my ancestors and forebears for the sacrifices they laid down to secure charter freedoms for us, but then accuses me of being reckless, you know, and malicious and foolish in the moment.
Hmm.
You know, I certainly don't want to puff myself up, but I'm one of the most reasonable people you'll ever meet anywhere. And, you know, I would be more than comfortable to engage in a public debate with any politician or any physician or any lawmaker about any of these issues. I can stand on my own 2 feet. I'm not a fool. And I say all that, again, not to puff myself up, but to help us to understand that, you know, when you try to be a reasonable voice, you understand history, you think through the issues. And when you're still thrown aside and just you have draconian charges laid against you, it's really an indictment of our culture. It's not so much an indictment, it's a charge against our culture. It indicates how foolish our culture is, how unthinking our culture is. And so in that respect, I can't say that I feel honored to receive the charge. I think I feel a combination of sorrow and sadness, but I don't feel any shame in receiving it, because I believe it's wrong, and it's more of a reflection of the foolishness of culture than my own foolishness in all of this. But, you know, we're confident the Lord will go before us, and, you know, in terms of, you know, how the courts rule, I have no idea. But I would like to think that they'll eventually just get thrown out and, you know, identified for what they are, which is a foolish attempt to control the population by a premier that must know on some level that what he's doing is wrong.
Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, I think this is actually the first pandemic outbreak of any virus or infection that we can remember in all of history where the church has actually bowed out from caring for the sick.
This is a fascinating thing. Like, not everybody in every church is running into hospitals, but I'd be prepared to do that. Our people would be prepared to do that. We have ministry in various institutions, the Southwest Detention Center and whatnot. We're barred from all of that. I think it's true that I'm the first Christian pastor in Canadian history, actually, to have been charged in such a way. There's been other churches that have been charged. The fine's been directed toward the church, but I think I'm the first. But unfortunately, I heard last weekend there was one in Leamington, one in Wheatley, one in Woodstock, and probably some pending charges in, you know, Alliston, Ingersoll, Waterloo, and so forth, where some other churches chose to stay open.
I mean, the church was still meeting during the bubonic plague, for crying out loud. So I don't know what the big deal is here. I'm curious, and a few of the saints that I've talked to and who've messaged me, hey, do you know this Aaron Rock guy? And I'm like, yeah. And they're curious to know, because there's been some silence, really, on the part of the local churches in Windsor, at least. What has been the response, if any, from the local churches in Windsor and the pastors in Windsor? I mean, I'm sure you know many pastors in Windsor. Has there been any response? Has it been positive, mostly negative? What's going on with the churches? Are they having your back through this?
So are you talking about like since my charge?
Right, yeah. Or even before. I mean, you've been outspoken the whole time.
Yeah. So for the last several months, there's been a few guys in Windsor that I've had, you know, semi-consistent conversation with that are definitely, you know, on our side, but they may be in a situation where they didn't get the support of their boards or whatnot, or they don't have tenure, you know, these things factor in. I was a little disappointed to discover that some guys that I would consider colleagues signed a letter in opposition to what we were doing. And actually that was used against us in conversations with a couple police officers that said, well, you know, other churches are content with Zoom, so why aren't you? So it actually, it's not just an opposing side, it actually worked against us and, you know, is arguably an influence in my charge. So, you know, these brothers, not meaning to do so, have actually brought harm upon me in our church, you know, which we'll have to think about at some point in terms of how to respond to that. Since the charges have been laid, crickets. I think I've received a text from two pastors, maybe three in Windsor. Let's say I forgot one, like I'll say four, but I think only three, one of which would be you. So crickets, total silence. I don't know why. Maybe they just don't know what to say. I mean, I feel bad for them if they're taking heat from their congregations. I do. But this wouldn't have happened if all the churches just said, no, we're opening, period. We're working on an effort, hopefully in January, maybe late January, where we can just kind of get churches to say we're opening. Like, how long is this going to go on for? I honestly don't understand it. Okay, I try to think of it from different perspectives. I don't understand it. I don't understand. I can understand someone having an alternative view, but I'm not even hearing the alternative views. People from other churches have contacted me, and they've essentially said, "I don't even know what the view of our church leadership is. They're not even addressing it. They're not saying anything. Nothing." They're not even providing like a logical alternative or however you want to call it to my viewpoint. They're just not saying anything. The standard approach seems to be whatever Doug Ford says is what we're going to do, period. And maybe that's convictional. Maybe there's some cowardice, although I don't want to just throw that word around too lightly. Maybe there's a lack of education, maybe there's a lack of church support. I actually don't even know, because I'm not even hearing, at least locally, why these men are doing this. I have no idea. It's very perplexing to me, but I mean, ultimately, I can't say I have any bitterness in my heart toward them. I would just say, if any of them are listening to this, and, you know, considering things in hindsight, if we'd all just stood up and said, no, we will not relinquish our solemn duties to minister to the holistic needs of our people, this problem would be solved.
Yep. And Harvest Bible Church, if I'm not mistaken, has been one of the more diligent churches in regards to, you know, registration and screenings and distancing and following all the different rules. And so when I did hear about the charge, I'm like, well, if any church is going to get dinged here, it's Harvest, really, because you guys had the whole thing set up. I mean, you're as far as like my church, I mean, we're so small that it was like, okay, just wear your mask and come in and that's it. We didn't really have the elaborate thing, but you guys were on the ball with this. So Just to, if there is anybody watching this who's maybe antagonistic, saying these silly things like these churches just want to kill people and they're so selfish, enlighten the folks about your safety measures and how actually diligent you were in those.
Yeah, so because we were one of the two initiating churches to get the province reopened, and it's funny, I'll just make a sidebar comment. I'm not looking for credit on that, but that's a fact. Okay, that's a fact. Our opponents have denied it, and I think there's some pride there. Our church and another church initiated a letter back in the spring. We then had some Jewish rabbis join us and a couple other pastors. We met with the premier's office on a Thursday and basically said, we're opening our churches. You need to make it happen, or we're going to, you know, file a charter lawsuit. This is on a Thursday. And we said, you've got till Monday. Monday, the premier gets up and says, we're opening. And it was my idea to actually have a percentage attached. That was my idea. We went back and forth. I was hoping to get 40%. They gave us 30. So because we were in the public eye, we thought, well, you know, we just can't afford to have any mess up. So far as I know, we're the only church doing temperature checks for a few months. You know, you don't get that at Costco or Walmart. We had the waivers going on. You know, we had pre-registration, check your name off the list. We had the physical distancing, the hand sanitizers, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, we did put people in plexiglass booths, but we did way more than what you would see in your typical business. We're almost at the level of what a hospital would be like in terms of admittance, at least. You know, as time went by, we admittedly asked for peer-reviewed medical articles from people without political liability to justify these protocols. They would just tell us straight up, we don't have them. But we still went with them. And, you know, by the time we got at the end of the summer, we dropped like the temp checks and that kind of thing. We don't get any credit. And again, it's not like we're looking for credit, but there's no outbreaks traced to our church. Nobody's died. We're fine. And so you do feel a little bit betrayed by the premier when you negotiate, you go above and beyond what the medical director suggests. The medical director in Windsor, don't know the guy, know his name, seen him on the news. You know, Windsor Essex Community Health Unit never responds to our letters, never returns phone calls, gives us zero credit. But he was the one that essentially told the police, you have to charge this guy. We don't want to issue the health order. It's on you. Pass the buck. That's a fact. And it's not my intention to throw him under the bus, per se, but I have suffered from this. And to a large degree, it's his fault. Because if he'd had a reasonable conversation with someone like myself and faith leaders that I've associated myself with, I think we could have come up with a reasonable compromise that was a win-win for everybody. But it's very clear to me, the premier and health officers, they're not looking for a win-win. They're just looking for a win on their end. And I'm not sure what the reason for that is. There's probably some politicking going on. They refuse to listen. You know, they banned protests. I'm not sure why they would do that. I mean, you're just pushing people toward extremism. They banned protests. They won't respond to your letters. It's an extremely frustrating situation for freedom-loving people to be forced into this kind of a situation. And again, I would say it's wrong.
Yeah, and to be honest, I personally would feel safer in Harvest Bible Church than I would at Walmart. I went to Walmart on Boxing Day. I wanted to return a heater to Princess Auto. They were closed. Canadian Tire was closed. Lowe's was closed. So they forced me into Walmart. And how many other people were forced into Walmart? And I'm sitting here going, oh my goodness. Like, I would feel safer personally in a church where I'm sitting in a chair and people are distancing and there's some protocol, not just back and forth madness. And so when I saw you post a picture of the sign, I think yesterday, on Sunday, I was like, yeah, this makes no sense from a pragmatic level that I could go.
it's interesting. There was a fellow online that said, "Oh, I can't believe they're packing. They're probably trying to pack 200 people into this church, this little church." Our church is 38,000+ square feet. We can seat 810 people in our main auditorium, 308 in our gym, and I think 108 or something like that in our third worship center. Like over 1,300 people I can fit in this building, no problem. But we've taken out, you know, 50% plus of the chairs, moved things around. We got people seated in different places. So for me to bring in a couple of hundred people per service in a building of this capacity, there's space everywhere. And you don't get any credit for that. It's the mental image is we're this little shoebox. We're just, you know, packing people into this little shoebox and, you know, causing irreparable harm. And it's just totally ignorant. You know, so even this idea of like the 10 people allowed in a church, well, hey, if you can have 10 people in your church and your church seats 20, God bless you. But when you start getting the size of, a church that's basically the size of Canadian Tire, and you're saying only 10 people are allowed in there, but, you know, the LCBO, which is the size of a small raised ranch in Windsor, you know, they can have X number of people in and out. Like, it doesn't even make sense from a logical perspective. And it demonstrates ignorance. It demonstrates thoughtless disregard. And at the end of the day, intentional or not, it's discriminatory. And intentional or not, it results in a feeling of religious persecution, which for some reason Christians seem very uncomfortable using this language. You don't need to worry about the motives. It results in the feeling of religious persecution. It's unjust, it's discriminatory, and it's unfair. And what it does, it opens the door in the box for all the church haters out there, there's lots of them, to jump on the church and literally to persecute the church. You know, when you're being told to, again, I don't want to use the language, but when you pick the most heinous words in the English language and just scroll through the hundreds and hundreds of comments just on our Facebook page, and you'll see those words in there. And we're being subjected to this because of bad reporting and because of, you know, a government that's posturing itself as, you know, justice warriors without regard for the founding institution of Western civilization, which is a free church.
Hmm. How would you respond to those Christian leaders who are saying, because there's a lot of them, that this isn't a black and white issue and that we have not yet reached that threshold of civil disobedience? Every Christian leader says, of course, there's always a situation wherein we need to disobey the government because they're issuing unrighteous decrees. But they're saying we have not reached that threshold. Now, I don't know where it is in their mind, but how would you respond to those leaders that say it's not black and white? This is a wisdom situation. We need to use Christian wisdom, and we're not at that threshold of civil disobedience yet.
Yeah, that's a good question. So a very simplistic response would be, then fine, close your church, but let me open mine because I have a very different view on it, right? So if you want to close your church, close it down. If you feel that's necessary, close it down. I will say I'm a little uncomfortable with the continued allegation of civil disobedience because I do not believe at this point that I've been civilly disobedient. And the reason for that, and this is a little sidebar, is the Constitution and the Charter is the highest law of our land. And I'm squared up with that. The criminal code, I haven't broken the criminal code. I would argue that many of the officers that have entered churches in our province and disrupted services have broken Section 176. So because I have, quote unquote, disobeyed a health order under the Reopening Ontario Act, you could argue, well, he's a lawbreaker, but actually, I am upholding the two highest laws of our land in the process. So that's maybe a minor point. But I think it needs to be stated. But I would say to pastors, it seems to me that there's two, maybe three deficits in their thinking. The one would be an insufficient view of spiritual warfare. I mean, you must understand that the devil doesn't, the devil masquerades as an angel of light. Is that not part of our theological stance? It's interesting. I can't recall them all, but I was reading something on persecution, and persecution doesn't go from, hey, green light, we love you guys, to red light, you got to stop. There's a sequence of steps that takes place when churches are persecuted, and we're well into that process. There's a passivity, a passive indifference. There's a censuring. There's a threatening and a sort of vilification process. I mean, there's a process we're going through. And for the life of me, okay, even if you disagree on our particular stance on this, for the life of me, give answer. Please give answer to this very simple question. How can you, as a Christian pastor, possibly justify the fact that Walmart and Costco, etc., are wide open, but your church is reduced to 10 people? You know, assuming you have more than 10 chairs. How can you justify that? Like, I really think that we have this notion, well, but if the intentions are there, well, you know what, if I'm well-intentioned and I murder someone, or I'm well-intentioned and I steal someone's stuff because I don't think they deserve it, you know, or I just really feel in love with this woman and I need to rescue her, so I'm going to commit an adulterous act. Like, do we get brownie points for having good intentions when we do wrongdoing? No. Wrong is wrong. And if the government, for whatever reason, says, we got to shut down churches, period, we're closing them all down, but we're, you know, leaving Walmart and Costco open. But the reason is, you know, we're not trying to pick on you. The reason is, you know, that people need to buy groceries, or people need to be able to buy 2x4s, or, you know, whatever it might be. Sorry, I'm not giving you any brownie points for your motives. Your actions are discriminatory. Your actions are illogical. They're wrong. And whether or not you are evil in your intention or not, it's still wrong. People still suffer from this. Churches suffer from this. Church people suffer from this. The gospel, sorry to say, the gospel doesn't go as far and wide. And I'll just say one more thing. There's a lot of people out there that are inconsistent in their theology too, because they're like, well, God is sovereign, right? We don't need to meet as a church. God is sovereign. If God's going to lead people to Christ, he's going to lead people to Christ. Well, you know what? Is God not sovereign over a virus too in your medical health? Because I could throw it back at you and say, well, oh, so if I got to exercise faith that God's going to just carry people on spiritually without the church, well, wouldn't it also follow if God is sovereign that he's just going to carry people on medically, whether or not there's a virus or hospitalization? We'd say, oh, no, 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 no. But a lot of inconsistencies, a lot of sloppy thinking, a lot of I's haven't been dotted and T's that haven't been crossed. So, I mean, I could speak about, you know, speak to this point for hours and hours and hours, but that would be kind of a summary overview of, you know, my response to that that criticism.
Yes, I've held for through this whole thing that critical thinking has been thrown out the window, and it's so emotional. Like, when was the last time we ever thought that we would infect somebody and that they might get sick and that they might die? That was never a thought in our minds, in our culture. It was like, you just go on with your life and people get sick and whatever. And this whole thing with the protecting the vulnerable, it's like, well, wait a minute. Think about this. Were we not protecting them before? Did we just figure this thing out now? And so it's very inconsistent. And it's leading to, frankly, I think societally, this whole thing about we're in this together. No, we're not. I've never seen
more division. There's more division, more meanness, more self-protection going on than ever before. They're throwing around this love your neighbor stuff, right? As they're cursing and denouncing the ministry of the the Church of Jesus Christ. This is not motivated by love. And I would just say this to my Christian listeners. Your antennas should go up, and you should always be suspicious when lost people, and now think about this, in a culture that aborts their children, confuses gender, denies the biological reality of gender, etc., suddenly gets all moral on us. Your antennas should automatically go up, but that's just not normal. So it's like serial killers typically don't donate to churches. And immoral people who are okay with infanticide and are confused about basic categories of human biology, if they start throwing around the love your neighbor card, probably should be a little suspicious of that. Somewhere in there, there's ill intent. But it seems to me that in the moment, Christian people, suddenly have tossed out the doctrine of total depravity and have a pretty high and lofty view of human nature and human benevolence. And I don't know, I don't get it. But I think you're right. There's a lot of emotion in this. There's a lot of fear mongering. I mean, it's almost like we're being reprogrammed to view ourselves as a living virus that is a threat to the rest of humanity. Whenever I get in my car, I put people's lives at risk. So, you know, we can talk about a theology of risk and reward as well. Again, when you tell people the same half-truths or lies for 9 or 10 months in a row, every single day, multiple times a day, the average person starts to believe it. But I think there is a bit of a reckoning coming, because, you know, I am sensing there's a lot of people too that are just kind of fed up, and they're starting to realize, yeah, this is more than about a virus. I'm not talking about conspiracy theories. I'm just talking about there's other factors at play here. So it's more than about mitigating against the virus. How can it not be that?
Yeah. Last question I want to ask you is basically, I guess it's just your opinion on this, because who's to say, unless you're a prophet. If you're a prophet, then let's hear it. But what do you think moving forward with the church is going to be the big takeaway? Like, let's say you're 30, 40 years down the line, you're reading a history book, a church history book, and you get to 2020. What is going to result from this as far as the church as a whole?
Yeah. I do think there's a spiritual winnowing, a separating taking place. For too long, we've had it pretty comfortable as Christians, and many of us have sort of, in a strange way, known that there needs to be some persecution and some challenges for the church to wake up. I think, frankly, those that are content with spectator Christianity or that don't value incarnational ministry, those churches are going to go away. They're either not going to reopen, or they're going to die a very slow and painful death. And unfortunately, that probably needs to happen in order for the church to be purified. I think there's going to be a rising up, a galvanizing of many Christians that are willing to count the cost unto death for their convictions and their beliefs. So I think there's going to be almost like, we've had the Protestant Church and the Catholic Church as two very distinct expressions of Christianity for many, many decades in our country. And I think there's now going to be a further separation of, I don't know what the names are going to be, but I think there's going to be a further separation of, frankly, the faithful Christians who are willing to count the cost, and those that are content with some sort of a limp, spectator-oriented, non-essential view of incarnational ministry. I know that sounds mean, it's going to infuriate people. Well, debate me on it then.
I'll say this. I'm kind of happy that The seeker sensitive movement has all but been totally shown to have no clothes on through this whole thing.
It's dead in the water. You know, there are some foolish people out there that are saying things like, oh, this is going to be time for like a great reset of the church, and the path forward for the church is just everything's online. I think a church in Kitchener from a friend of mine, they're going to stay online. They think it's great. You know what? You're not going to make disciples. I'm sorry to say. I'll prophesy on that one. You're not going to make disciples. You clearly do not understand human nature or human need. If you think the church can be reduced down to a sermon and music that you just observe and watch like you're some sort of a spectator, it's almost like virtual sex or something. No relationship, no intimacy, no trust, no commitment, no true knowledge of the other. It's just an observational kind of Christian experience. But our culture has been being primed for this for a long time, right? Through too much time on the television, too much time in front of the camera like we're doing, too much time video gaming, like all these kinds of sort of verge texting, you know, hey, will you marry me on a text? I'm breaking up with you on a text, like these virtual fake relationships that we're sort of being acclimatized to. And now we have a generation or two that's been raised on those. And they just said, well, why don't we do this in the church too? You are going to die a long and painful death. And you will not be honored by the Lord, because that is the Creator has not designed us to function that way. Read your Bible. So I think there's going to be a winnowing and a separation. Where I'm still thinking and processing is, depending on how the response is going to be the next several months and then the court cases and stuff, it may be time for us to get out of Dodge. You know, it may be that Ichabod, you know, the Lord has departed, is written across our nation. Maybe large groups of Christians are going to have to leave the country, you know, or relocate to more Christian-friendly parts of the country. The big question is where and how would that look like. But it might be something of that magnitude. Sounds kind of crazy. Who would have thought we'd be discussing this? But it might be if culture essentially says, look, we've decided, they're not going to say it this way, but this will be the message. We've decided that church is not essential. And we don't need you. We have our own systems and structures. Then, yeah, there'll be a faithful remnant that stays behind to try to win lost people. But essentially, then, you're in a situation where we can say the culture has been lost. And it might need to just be plunged into an absolute moral abyss, you know, before there's revival. This has happened time and time again. Most of the people in our country came here from other countries, many of whom were under some sort of religious persecution or persecution. I would put freedom in the religious category, because freedom's actually a Christian idea. You know, the church being the first free institution of Western civilization. So previously known as Christendom, we call it Western civilization, it's Christendom. You take that away, you essentially bankrupt your culture and your nation, and you have nothing left. You just hollow it out. And, you know, for the sake of our children and our grandchildren, who knows, this generation and the next, you know, again, may need to get out of Dodge. But, you know, ultimately, those are sort of my thoughts on it right now. I don't know exactly what's going to happen. Nobody does. But we certainly need to prepare ourselves for the worst, but hope for the best, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. And you heard it here, folks. First, folks, online church is spiritual cyber fornication. Is that accurate?
Way to go.
Would you agree with that assessment?
Well, I think it's a suitable analogy to at least capture some of the problem that we're experiencing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's end on that note. How about we end on that note? Thank you so much.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on and talking with me and sharing your story openly. And I hope it was a blessing to everyone. This has been another episode of No Compromise Christianity, where you definitely heard the stuff you're not going to hear in church. God bless you. Hey, thanks so much for watching this edition of No Compromise Christianity. We all know well, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Google, these companies hate biblical content. And frankly, it's only a matter of time before No Compromise Christianity probably gets deplatformed from these social media platforms. So here's what you can do. Go to nocompromisechristianity.com, scroll down to our newsletter sign up, put your email in there, and sign up for our newsletter. That's how you can stick it to Facebook and YouTube and Twitter when they deplatform us. So please sign up for our newsletter and don't let the communists win. They won't, because Christ is king. So go ahead and sign up. Thanks so much for watching. God bless you.